We're talking about PTSD here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Anyone who has witnessed or experienced a traumatic event, think combat, rape, violent assault, natural disaster, they can develop PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD is an anxiety disorder caused by very stressful, frightening, or distressing events, which are often relived through flashbacks and nightmares. A lot of the research to this point has focused on war veterans or active duty military personnel. The condition formerly known as shell shock first came to prominence when men returned from the trenches of World War I. But researchers have learned a lot over the century of seeing PTSD outside of combat. Have you experienced PTSD outside the military? Were you in a car crash or were you the victim of a violent crime? Did you lose a family member or friend? How did you find help, and what advice would you give to others? We're at 800-642-1234. Chad Wetterneck is a clinical psychologist for Rogers Behavioral Health, and he specializes in post-traumatic stress disorder. Chad, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I imagine police officers, firefighters are more likely to experience PTSD. Is that true? Is that more common among certain jobs?
Yes. If you're exposed either directly through a challenging situation where you think your life might be compromised, or you see someone else's life compromised or the after effects of that, you could also develop PTSD.
And so among health professionals, it might be more prevalent.
Definitely. I'd say police officers, firefighters, even some jobs where you don't really know that they're exposed to death or the aftermath of it, or high-risk situations like people that are helping people retrieve cars, tow truck drivers. You know, they have cars whizzing by them. Every 6 days, there's generally a tow truck driver that's hit by a car. So that's known in their field, and they know that they're at risk every day.
Hmm. What about nurses who are very close to stressful situations? They have certainly orders to carry out, but they're seeing a lot.
Right. So I would say nurses, EMTs, those that see the aftermath of accidents. A lot of people think that you have to actually be exposed to the near-death situation, but for people that see the aftermath, so you see people coming in that were shot or in a car accident. Those that arrive on the scene, but then those that are trying to help them in the hospitals are also faced with the prospect of developing PTSD.
So outside of the military, outside of combat, outside of the emergency responders and the healthcare setting, what other kinds of experiences can cause people to develop PTSD?
So anything from car accidents, natural disasters, whether that be a hurricane or a tornado, And really more commonly anything that I would call interpersonal violence, interpersonal trauma. So physical assaults and especially sexual assaults are likely to result in PTSD.
Do people need to be in actual danger? What if they've seen an event at a distance, like a car crash?
Sure. That could happen. It's a lower likelihood if they've witnessed the event. A lot of people ask about what about those folks that were either on the scene or maybe watched the events of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And what I normally say is that if they develop all the symptoms, then I'm going to treat it like it's PTSD. I think if you just look at our diagnostic criteria, maybe most people wouldn't say that witnessing something on TV could lead to developing PTSD. But the mind has a funny way in which it works where it can kind of put you on the scene. And while watching something life-threatening, I think the key is, too, that it's perceived as life-threatening to the person involved or to that person who's watching. That could result in the development of PTSD.
We're talking with Chad Wetterneck. He is a clinical psychologist for Rogers Behavioral Health, specializing in PTSD. You can join in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the common symptoms or how treatment can help people feel better? Have you seen someone's behavior change after a traumatic event? Were you able to help them connect with services? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to get into the symptoms, but can PTSD stem from a person being repeatedly traumatized? I'm thinking of child abuse.
Yes, it could. You know, I think in our field, there's a lot of things that we categorize as different types of whether it's a traumatic event or, you know, we look at a concept like bullying, where a child might feel as though whether their life is at risk. They don't really know what could happen to them. And it's a lot more simple than people asking for their lunch money, whether they're being physically threatened or actually physically harmed. If that happens over and over again, you know, your mind is going to develop a response that says, I have to do anything to try to survive here. And they're going to think about it a lot more often than other people that aren't faced with those challenges.
But how does that work when one person develops PTSD after a traumatic event? Another person experiencing the same thing doesn't develop it.
Right. That's something that we're continuing to research, like what are the risk factors for PTSD, and then also what are the resiliency factors. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's the person's interpretation of the event. I mean, most people, if they experience something that could have been life-threatening, aren't going to come out of it only with a thought of, wow, thankfully I'm alive, and that's their only thought. It's hard not to think, I almost died in that particular event. But what they do afterward is pretty important as well. And most of the time people are thinking about what happened, maybe internalizing it. They're dealing with some really difficult emotions, and they're really feeling vulnerable. And just talking about the event itself is going to make people feel even more vulnerable. So they often avoid talking about it. Now, some of the factors that might be helpful for people after the event would be to find someone that they trust, that they feel at least relatively safe with, and be able to talk about it. It doesn't even have to be a mental health professional, but allowing someone else to either give them support, just to hear them out, and the mere exposure to allowing themselves to think about it might help stave off some of the development of the disorder itself.
What are those symptoms, those clinical symptoms you look for?
Yeah, so there's really five main areas, and they all have to lead to some major impairment in the person's life. But the first is that they have to experience a traumatic event and or be closely associated to a traumatic event. The key here is that it's their perception that it was traumatic or that it could have been life-compromising or life-challenging to themselves or those around them. It doesn't matter if they find out later on that the danger wasn't real. So I'm remembering a couple of bank tellers I've worked with that had been held up, but what they didn't realize is the person holding them up at the bank was actually just had their hand in their jacket pointing at them and inferring that they had a gun. They found that out moments after the person was caught, but their mind couldn't undo the terror that was involved in that situation and the high level of risk. And it couldn't resolve it just by that knowledge alone. So experiencing a traumatic event would be one of those events and perception of the risk. The second area is has to do with remembering the event. There's a number of nuances to this, but the main things that happen are people either experience nightmares about the event. Those nightmares are not always an exact replay of what happened. Sometimes, you know, your mind's trying to protect you even in its sleep, and it's someone's chasing you and you can't quite see it, but you still experience that level of terror that you may have had during the traumatic event. For other people, it's they're having flashbacks. And so this is while you're waking, you almost seem to lose touch with part of your surrounding reality. And the environment feels as though you're back in one or more of those traumatic situations. So, for example, if you said you had PTSD and were sitting here and you were having a flashback, even though you know no one else is in the room besides the three of us, you might feel as though someone's standing behind you and about to physically harm you in some way. Part of you knows it's not real, but it's almost like sitting in an IMAX theater and it's playing out, and many of your senses are actually saying, yeah, this is about to happen.
Chad Wetterneck is our guide. He specializes in PTSD. He's a clinical psychologist. You can join in with your experiences, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Are you a veteran who experienced PTSD? What was the experience like? What advice would you give to someone outside the military? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about PTSD here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A traumatic event is not remembered and categorized in a person's past in the same way as other life events. This trauma continues to invade the senses, and a person experiencing PTSD will relive the life-threatening experience, reacting in both body and mind as though the traumatic event is still occurring. So we're discussing where we see PTSD outside the military, how to treat it. Have you seen someone's behavior change after a traumatic event? Were you able to help them connect with services, or did you feel uneasy about stepping in? What questions do you have about responding to PTSD? Join in at 800-642-1234. Clinical psychologist Chad Wetternick is our guide on PTSD. Let's go to the phones now with Chris joining us from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
I didn't think I'd get through. Well, I have a question. I heard Chad from Rogers Memorial, and I have PTSD. My husband was shot and killed by our sheriff's department at our home. It was about 10 years ago. And then my daughter's best friend drowned a year later. So we all have trauma in the home. My question is, I slowly turned to alcohol. I'm a registered nurse, or I was, and I turned to alcohol to cope with it, and it slowly came on over the last 10 years. I had like 4 or 5 relapses. Today I'm 5 months sober, thanks to Rogers Memorial here. But my question is, was it the genetic part of my brain that made me turn to alcohol, or was it the PTSD that turned me to alcohol, or was it both, or was one more stronger than the other?
Chris, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Chris, I appreciate you sharing your story and giving so many details. I think that's really courageous of you to ask, because I know many people out there with PTSD do go on to use some sort of substance to try to cope with the effects of it. To answer your question, I don't know that we know for sure the role that genetics plays. We do believe that genetics does play a role in people's likelihood to have an addiction issue, and also whether or not they might be more predisposed to develop an anxiety disorder like PTSD. There's just a myriad of factors that contribute to this. But your story in terms of using alcohol to try to cope with all the effects of PTSD and the terrible things that have happened is probably more the norm than it's only you. And I'm really happy to hear that you've had 5 months of sobriety and that we were able to be helpful for you. And for anyone else out there that's trying to cope with PTSD by whether it's with drinking or, smoking marijuana or something like that, there is help for you. And while it might help regulate your symptoms in the short term, in the long term, really, the symptoms are going to continue if they've been there already for a few years.
Chris, thank you. Let's go to Kat now, joining us from Watertown. Good morning, Kat.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just thought I'd bring up that a lot of us, so I have never gone through PTSD myself, but I found out that my daughter had been sexually abused by my ex-husband now, and she has it. So if you're a supporter of somebody who has PTSD, it can be very difficult and hard to understand, especially a child. And I have a great therapist who helped me through it, and I just wanted to kind of tell listeners that if you're helping somebody through it, what they're doing seems really awful. But at least for children, what I've been taught is to sort of almost go back to the basics of just loving them through it and showing them support through it. And it's worked. So I know it's really hard. Like if you're dealing with a child who's been abused in some sort of way, like just know that you should try to love them through it, even though it's very painful and they're hurting you and they won't talk to you and they won't show you love.
Kat, appreciate your insights. What do you see there, Chad?
Yeah, and depending on the age in which the abuse occurred, it really does interrupt children and adolescents' ability to develop in ways where their relationships remain healthy or challenges them to be able to understand their emotions. I mean, a very common reaction in PTSD is that people want to kind of shut off the fear part of what happened to them, almost as though they want to turn off like a tap in their brain just to shut off the anxiety. And they're able to do that. The only problem is there isn't a tap for each specific emotion, and they end up shutting off the emotional valve. And so what you're describing here is I see this all the time with children that have experienced that abuse. They don't want to be activated in any way emotionally because it reminds them of emotions in general, which reminds them of the fear and sometimes the shame that follows after that. And it does make your job as a parent or a loved one really difficult. And you also made note that the therapy itself, most of the evidence-based therapies, they don't sound fun because they are very difficult, just like experiencing trauma itself. And you are right that if people were to hear what we do without the context of why we do it, it would sound very challenging to allow yourself or even your child to go through it. And I am glad to hear that you just kept up with loving your child. That's what they need. And at some time when they're ready, they're going to be more receptive to it. But they have to learn over time that you're safe and other people can be safe too.
And Chad, each child is different. So that journey through what they're going through can be very different, I'm sure, clinically. Where do you see breakthroughs? When do you see, like, yeah, that child is making progress?
Well, I think it's when multiple areas of their life are starting to improve. So besides some of the symptoms we started talking about, when those symptoms seem to be less interfering, it's when they're able to connect with others, when they're able to express a wide variety of emotions, and they look as though they're receiving care and love from other people, and they're able to give it to other people as well. Trauma can really stunt all of those areas of love, whether it's toward oneself, toward others, or being able to receive it.
Let's go to Maya now, joining us in Madison. Hi, Maya.
Hi there. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share that I experienced child abuse in the 70s and 80s, and at that time, that wasn't talked about that much. When I got away from my family of origin, I started experiencing extreme depression, and that's kind of how my PTSD exacerbated itself. I have to say that talk therapy, especially it was pretty much right away when I was around 17, seemed to help. The meds, meds for depression have helped at various times. And it wasn't until being an adult, probably about 10 years ago, that I was diagnosed with PTSD. And what I feel is most important besides the talk therapy is survivors actually talking about how much child abuse and domestic violence there is and how there are a lot of us walking around with PTSD. And it's not so much the flashbacks, but it's the subtle effects of walking around constantly being on guard. It's in the back of your head where you think that other people are having that same thought. I liked what the doctor said about it's like you know somebody's there, but, you know, it's like a movie, an IMAX. And my question was, my question is, does EMDR or the psychoactive drugs that they now have available, does he know whether they work as effectively? Because sometimes the medicine doesn't seem to keeps everything normal, but it doesn't really alleviate a lot of the symptoms.
A lot of the root things there. Maya, thank you.
Yeah, Maya, thank you for sharing all those details as well. I do want to answer your question, and there's just a couple of other points you brought up that I think would be helpful for everyone to hear. One is that when you experience abuse as a child, you know, most children don't realize, they might not know that they're the only ones that have experienced abuse. They might think that everyone believes that this is the way families function. So, you know, a child isn't expected to be able to know that this is weird or this is different, this isn't right. And It's not until talking and coming into the therapy, perhaps for depression or substance use or sleep problems, interpersonal difficulties, that people end up finding out, actually, you know, you had some pretty significant trauma in your life. And you mentioned, you know, that feeling of what we refer to as hypervigilance. It's always being on edge and looking for danger. Not everyone has flashbacks and nightmares. Sometimes the trauma contributes to the other symptoms of PTSD developing. Those can be just as impairing as flashbacks and nightmares, that constant sense of something's about to go wrong, and the feeling that without emotions in your life, you are likely to become more depressed. You start restricting all your activities because everything does become threatening to you, and you lose connection with the world, not just the things in the world, but the people. So I'm glad to hear that you went to therapy. I wish it could have been found out earlier. But in terms of what helps people, different types of psychotherapy help people. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about it a little bit more. But there are three main therapeutic approaches. And I know after the break that's coming up, I'll be able to talk a little bit
we'll
more about those.
We'll get to those. Yes. Chad Wetternick, a clinical psychologist with Rogers Behavioral Health. Your questions, your experiences with PTSD throughout the hour. They're welcome. 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Post-traumatic stress disorder has long been one of the hardest mental health problems to diagnose because some patients try to mask their symptoms while others may exaggerate them. So we're talking about PTSD, where we see it, how to treat it. We're looking at this journey through treatment with your questions, your experiences. Welcome throughout the hour, 800-642-1234. Chad Wetternick is a clinical psychologist for Rogers Behavioral Health, and he specializes in PTSD. He stays with us. Chad, before the break, we were talking about different treatment approaches. What are some of those approaches? What's working?
Sure. There are a number of things that likely work. However, there's really only been three treatment approaches that have been highly studied enough that I would actually recommend. So in the last year or so, our American Psychological Association has been reviewing the different disorders and looking at the research evidence to say what supports the best recommendation if someone's coming in with a disorder like PTSD. Last year, they concluded that there were three treatments that met a high standard. So we should be referring people to the highest standard was actually met by two treatments called prolonged exposure and another one called cognitive processing therapy, and then another treatment called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR, met a very high level of research support as well, but kind of on the tier below those first two. The good news is that all three of those treatments work. Many of them have been compared to each other in direct trials, in scientific studies, and they find to have equal benefits in helping people for the most part.
So EMDR, what does that entail?
Well, EMDR involves... And that I'll just be honest, that's not my main area in which I use, but EMDR entails being able to create a very safe environment for the patient, training them in a number of different coping skills to make sure that they can make it through all the different situations where flashbacks or nightmares may occur, or they're very hypervigilant and need to get through certain situations, even just daily activities like going to the store. And when the patient is ready, then the idea is to have them recount the trauma itself while trying to stimulate their visual hemispheres, which will also stimulate brain activity from the left to right hemisphere. So I'm talking about the theory here. Most of the theories for our psychological studies are very hard to prove. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that while telling their traumatic event, they will watch either the therapist move potentially a hand in front of them from left to right, or they may watch a light that moves at a certain pace from left to right. And while telling that traumatic story, almost as if it's happening again right now, it's allowing them to connect both sides of their brain and kind of process and put in the right spots where that information should be filed, so that When part of it comes up, it doesn't kind of fire neurons in all directions, activate the limbic system and say, you know, fight, flight, or flee, freeze from the situation.
So it's like an organization for the brain. Actually, the eye movement is helping your brain categorize this traumatic event?
Well, and like I said, that's the theory behind it.
Okay.
You know, it's hard to prove and sometimes hard to disprove these things. You know, the interesting thing about this is that after a therapy gets validated and is said to work, which EMDR does work for folks with PTSD, then they start doing stuff like, well, what if we gave the whole treatment package, but we separated out and left out the eye movements? And they've actually run a study like this. They refer to them as a dismantling study. They compare the main package to only components of it. And what they ended up finding in that first study that dismantled and compared the full package to the full package minus any eye movements or reference to them is that there was no significant differences in healing. So here we have a case of, we know that the therapy works. We know it's helpful. People should, you know, consider that one of their top three options. But the theory behind it isn't supported, at least with that initial study of trying to dismantle what works and what doesn't work.
One of the treatments is called prolonged exposure.
Yes.
And it's likely repeating something, putting perhaps a spider in a room with someone who is afraid of spiders, doing something over and over. What happens there?
Yeah, so prolonged exposure is a specific type of exposure therapy. Exposure therapies are the most highly researched and most recommended therapy for anxiety disorders, whether it's PTSD or something else. The specific one for PTSD is called prolonged exposure. And while it's very effective, I like to joke with people that I train that I think it could have came up with a better name, only because prolonged makes it seem like it's never going to end. And then, of course, exposure sounds like it's going to be really challenging. And all of these treatments are challenging. But in an exposure work, what you're asking the patient to do is identify situations that they're avoiding, whether it be internal thoughts or images or sensations or anything out in their environment that reminds them of the trauma. And we know that our fear networks develop very rapidly, and the associations between the actual trauma and things closely related to it spread pretty quickly in our brain because it's trying to keep us alive. And so many things in your environment will remind you of the traumatic event. Our goal is to try to develop a treatment plan in which we are exposing you gradually to lower level stimuli that will give you some anxiety and remembrance of the situation without pushing you over the edge, and then get you to stay in that situation long enough where your body learns to correct the anxiety response. And basically what that looks like is, we ask people to rate what their anxiety is, and we might say from 0 to 7. And they think that if they're exposed to certain situations, their anxiety will go up to a 5, to a 6, to a 7, and that they think it will stay there forever until the situation is resolved. What they don't know is that while our mind is giving us these danger signals and it's alerting our body to be more hyper-aroused and anxious, that after a while, it actually learns, if I stay in the situation, sometimes for seconds, but more likely for minutes, that it recognizes there isn't an actual danger there. And the fear response diminishes on its own through repeated exposure or presentation of these things that were previously scary. You know, one of the symptoms we didn't get to talk about of PTSD was avoidance. And that's one of the primary symptoms. And people are avoiding anything internally or externally that reminds them of the event. So exposure therapy is actually kind of trying to cut to the root of what they think is happening, which is target the avoidance, undo that, because that's a maintaining factor. And people do, if they stay in the exposure area, they will, their body will reset.
We're talking with Chad Wetternick. He's a clinical psychologist at Rogers Behavioral Health, specializing in PTSD. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a police officer or firefighter who developed PTSD after responding to an emergency? Were you provided enough time, enough support to help you heal? What challenges have you had to overcome? What questions do you have about PTSD? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Rick now, joining us from Burlington. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
So I had my own experience around 6 years ago when I was living in Tennessee. The short version was I went down a 120-foot cave shaft with 80 feet of rope. So I spent 3 days stuck at the bottom of this cave. And by the third day, I mean, I've had experiences where, you know, you think you're going to die, where you're like, I could have died. But that was the first time I was 100% certain I was going to die. And that, there was a lot of traumatic things that happened during those 3 days. But that, the certainty of death, was one of the big things. And I don't think I would have, at the end I climbed out, and I don't think I would have been able to do that unless I had been 100% certain I was going to die. But afterwards, what helped me get through that is because I was, for a year, I was plagued by nightmares and I was reliving the thing. But what helped me get through it was one of the things that helped me get through it. One, immediately afterwards, I wrote it all down. Like, as soon as I woke up from my trauma coma afterwards, I wrote the whole thing down. And then after that, I shared it with every single person I possibly could. And so talking about it sort of normalized it in a way that I could then look at it differently.
Rick,
and then I was also able to talk with other I had talked with combat veterans who felt that same experience, and I was able to talk with them about it. And talking about it and sharing it helped a lot.
Rick, how are you doing today, may I ask?
Today, it's not so bad. It takes very specific stimuli to sort of bring it back. Like the smell of clean mud will bring me back, or hanging from a rope will especially bring it back.
Thank you.
After all the talking about it, it's sort of over the years of sort of talking about it with everyone and sort of reliving it in tiny ways, I no longer associate it as a negative experience. I mean, sure, it was negative, but I associate it with sort of this strange survivor's pride and that it was a transformative experience now. So I've begun to associate it more positively. So even when I'm sort of brought back there, I'm reminded of all the horrible things, but I'm also reminded of, like, the personal growth that's come from it.
And Rick, thank you for sharing that story. It's, you know, like the other stories, it's really powerful, and it's nice to hear that there was some resolution to it as well. A number of things you said just stand out to me, and that, you know, our mind is really additive. We don't ever lose the experiences. Sometimes they can get buried pretty deep, but even though you were able to kind of like write and talk your way through this, and to me, I would say you were actually doing some pretty good self-directed exposure therapy. You were not avoiding it. You were allowing yourself to think about it. And that's really the key difference in people who are continuously pelted by the thoughts and nightmares and flashbacks, is we're asking them in a safer environment to choose to accept that those things are already happening. And it seems to be that acceptance guided by the therapist that is often what results in the change and allowing them to habituate and get used to these things. Sounds like you did it on your own. I don't know where you came up with that, but it was pretty brilliant. And you're really identifying some of the things that lead people from not developing full-blown PTSD. It's being able to connect with it without avoiding it, even if it's with yourself, to be able to talk with others about it, to get support, to know that you're not alone, and to practice like being connected to humans, other humans, and getting that emotional experience. So thank you for sharing that story.
We're with clinical psychologist Chad Wetternick. We're talking about PTSD. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Have you experienced PTSD? Were you in a car crash or were the victim of a violent crime? Did you lose a family member or a friend? How did you find help, and what advice would you give to others? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about PTSD here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some active duty troops, police officers, firefighters, sometimes they downplay symptoms because they fear being sidelined or don't want to admit weakness. Now researchers are working to develop brain scans and blood tests and other objective measures that might take some of the uncertainty out of diagnosing PTSD. The most common method currently relies on a subjective process in which patients answer questions about symptoms and clinicians then make a judgment. We're looking at risk factors, we're looking at treatment options, and the support networks that are out there for victims and loved ones. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Clinical psychologist Chad Wetternick stays with us for this conversation. Chad, why is avoidance an issue with PTSD? Do you see avoidance in your practice?
Yes. With everyone that has PTSD, there's some degree of avoidance. And avoidance generally occurs because people don't want to be put back in that situation. And it's not just the external reminders of the situation. It's also the internal reminders. You know, keep in mind what happened in those moments during a or multiple traumas are they felt more vulnerable than they ever did in their life. Anything that is related to the traumatic event triggers that feeling of vulnerability. And I guess I could just ask you or anyone else, tell me one of the most shameful or vulnerable things that have occurred in your life. And you'd probably have to take a really hard gulp and consider, do I really want to go there and share
there?
This?
Right.
And you know, it involves life or death situations. So it makes perfect sense why people avoid.
Let's go to Billy now, joining us from Wabasha, Minnesota. Hi, Billy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a combat wounded vet. I've had the brain scans and stuff like that, and I'm in treatment for PTSD, and I keep hearing you say when you recount the incident, well, when you're in a war for a long period of time, it's multiple incidents. The entire thing is the incident, and one of the things, I'm an artist also, and I've used that to help me, but one of the other things is I'm very interested in some of the research that's been going on with psilocybin and microdosing with psilocybin, and I wonder if you know anything about that.
Thanks, Billy. What do we know about brain scans and psilocybin? Is that what it's called?
So there are different types of therapeutic approaches that involve different types of drugs, mm-hmm. one of them being psilocybin. First, I want to thank Billy for calling in. I want to thank you for your service. You are right that you know, if you were in a combat situation, even if you were someone that was supporting a combat situation, your life was at risk basically the entire time you were deployed. And for the people that I treat, for those that are not veterans, most of the folks that we work with have had dozens, sometimes hundreds of physical and sexual abuse events that have happened. So similar to your experience as a veteran in a war situation, we can only do the best we can in trying to pull out some of the... It's hard to say that some traumas are worse than the others because we never want to imply that some are easier than the others because none of them are easy. But we try to localize it to some of the ones that come up more frequently in nightmares and flashbacks or lead to more avoidance. So we have to narrow it down to something to do some of the different types of behavioral and talk therapy that we do. In terms of some of the types of approaches that you're talking about, you know, the area of trying to scan one's brain, that's an area that's growing in research. It's really hard to always be able to make a lot of solid conclusions from some of these things because, you know, we'd like to see the brain in real time. So, you know, we do fMRIs and that can measure where blood is flowing to the brain during a certain time, but you often have to stay very still in your MRI machine. And what it's doing is looking at where blood flow is over the period of time. It is helpful, though, to see and rule out other types of issues and see if there's anything complicating the approach. You mentioned psilocybin, which other people might identify as mushrooms. There is some research on that. There aren't any randomized clinical trials that I'm aware of at this time supporting its use. But as I said, many things can be helpful and we just don't know. I will mention, though, that there is one group called MAPS. They're MDMA assisted psychotherapy studies. They are currently in the phase 3 of their trials and looking to see if MDMA can help people that have already tried both other medications and other types of behavioral or talk therapies and have not received help. And they have published some studies on this, so there is at least one randomized clinical trial out there that shows that it can be helpful for those that seem to be either treatment resistant or just aren't able to do what's asked in therapy because it's too terrifying for them. So there are other approaches that we're going to find are also helpful.
We have time for just one more call. Let's go to Shannon, who is joining us from Madison. Hi, Shannon.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say my son is only 9, but has had multiple surgeries due to medical condition and has developed PTSD and anxiety. And I was just curious how the treatment at Rogers may differ for children versus adults who may not be able to reason as well because they're still children.
Yeah. So, Shannon, thank you for bringing that up. And hopefully I can provide some information for you. This is another area that isn't talked about much when people go to a hospital setting. And whether there is a chance of something life-threatening or not, even if it's 1 in 100, people can develop an avoidance of hospitals, and it can look just like PTSD. And for children that don't understand or feel like any trip to the hospital could be life-threatening, potentially, especially with that many surgeries, I'm not surprised that that happened. And I'm sure that there's more people out there that don't realize that this could actually result in PTSD. In terms of what Rogers does, so I mentioned three main therapies that have been well researched. There's another type of therapy that also has met a pretty high level of research, and it's called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And what it does is it combines a lot of the elements of the two most validated treatments out there, cognitive processing therapy and prolonged exposure. It has a strong family component in which the whole family will learn how to interact with each other in different ways. You know, even if you're a very, I'm sure you're a very loving patient, and you know, people have a hard time still receiving love because they're trying not to feel when they have PTSD. So we often have to have them take a different route from what they're doing. We do have actually an adolescent PTSD program in our Brown Deer location that just started in January, where we utilize trauma-focused CBT. Now, in terms of how it differs from some of the adult versions of treating PTSD, you're right that children, we can't take as directive an approach. They're not always as aware of their emotions, especially, I think you said that your son is 9 years old. I mean, he's just starting to learn and develop and put words to things, and he may not be able to make sense of these things. So some of the approaches within trauma-focused CBT have them engage in activities, use metaphors, have them engage in activities where they're like writing their life story. So they're writing about any aspect of their life that they're able to, but not just focusing on the traumatic event. And that allows them to build up and practice being able to write and ease their way into actually thinking about the event in a more safe and therapeutic method, where they can still habituate, though, get some of their feelings and thoughts out there, and then talk with the therapist and the other family members to be able to support and point out some of the resilience on, you know, every day they're still living with it, but now they were willing to accept and face it. So we have to take some indirect approaches, but the core features really are about trying to shift a person's perspective on it and also expose them to it so they can habituate to the fears.
So in the last minute we have with you, less than a minute, where can people find more information about PTSD or other resources?
Right. So you know, any place that treats PTSD. So, I mean, obviously I would recommend that you could look at Rogers Behavioral Health website and see what we offer and recommendations that we have. I mean, we do pretty complete assessments on folks. And we will tell you that if you don't need a level of care as high as what we offer, we have a lot of people that we can refer to in many areas, not just in Southeast Wisconsin, but across the country where we know there's experts. There are organizations such as the International Study for Traumatic Stress, where you can look at their website. They have clinicians that have been vetted through one or more of the empirically supported treatments. If you are looking for help out there, you could look at something like Psychology Today website. You want to look for someone, though, that lists PTSD or trauma as one of their primary treatment
modes, avenues.
Exactly. Yeah. And if they have a list of 20 specialties, it's kind of hard to be a specialist in 20 things. So try to find someone that they say, this is really my main area of focus.
Chad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Chad Wetternick is a clinical psychologist at Rogers Behavioral Health, specializing in PTSD. And we should mention that Rogers BH is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.